Is your positive growth and change? Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Aware Show. It's always so good to be here. I hope you can hear that in my voice. I love this place. So welcome. We're going to have a great hour today of exploring our minds in an entertaining way, because it's always a better way to have it. So let me ask you a question. Did you know that there's a difference? There's actually a difference between positive obsessing and negative obsessing. Negative obsessions are things that cause anxiety. They can be harmful to your health. Things like negative thoughts, being obsessed with negative thoughts, or obsessed with fatalistic thinking, like, you know, if I do that, then this will happen. And you can't do that because what if this happens? The what if type of thinking, right? Well, positive obsessions, if you channel them correctly, can actually fuel the fire of your life because they keep you on purpose. And it's the energy that you can use to channel that type of energy into something creative, something that cultivates your creativity. And that is exactly what my guest today is talking about, Dr. Eric Maisel. He calls a productive obsession, it's a productive obsession, something that's productive, in his latest book called Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions, which I would love to know what that is. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hi, Lisa. Great to be with you.
You too. So what exactly is the difference between a productive and an unproductive obsession, or a positive or a negative? I kind of put that spin on it.
That's right. Those are right ways to say it. We have to go back a little way. Maybe more than 100 years ago, one fellow in the dark, distant history of therapy defined all obsessions as intrusive, unwanted thoughts. He defined obsessions as negative things. And so for the last 100 years in the clinical world, they've only been able to think about obsessions as negative things, and that's bled over into the general culture, where most people, when they hear the word obsession, they think about OCD and mm-hmm. negative things. Mm-hmm. And so one of the main reasons for doing this book was to bring that word back to the other side of the ledger, because we've known for thousands of years, you know, from our writers and artists and scientists and what have you, that there are definitely such things as productive obsessions. That was the impetus for writing the book.
Now, wait, how do you figure that? I mean, first of all, who was the therapist that coined this kind of 100 years ago?
I don't remember the guy's name. Oh, okay. I have to go back to the book.
Sorry about that. Just
in
general.
It was, okay. one of those moments.
Traditional.
In the pre-Freudian time.
Oh.
You know, many things get defined. You know, you may know how, you know, syndromes work in therapy. A group of people sit around and name a disease by chatting about it.
Mm-hmm.
In the mental health world, it's very different from the, so to speak, regular medical world. So we have lots of words that have been, you know, taken by therapy that the common parlance isn't available anymore. Even common sadness. I mean, it's really hard for anybody to say, I'm sad anymore. We have to go to that depression place.
Right.
Very fast in our normal conversation.
It is interesting the way that it's morphed. I mean, GAD, I think it's general anxiety disorder. It's
exactly.
It's a common term, but it gets you a prescription for an antidepressant.
Exactly.
Through your, what do you call the medical, through the HMOs and things like that.
That's right.
So it's like it's turned into a big business more than it has anything else.
And not only is that its own problem, but when language gets usurped, it's hard for other people, it's hard for you and me to use a word like obsession in a kind of normal, everyday way, when in the background there's that shadow of OCD and, you know, other images of obsession, all of which are negative.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, there's definitely the extreme versions of it. I mean, we've got the whole Mel Gibson thing that's going on,
And all the classical kind of hand-washing obsessions and, you know,
right.
is your door locked obsessions. And those exist. To answer the question that you asked at the beginning, what's the difference?
Yeah.
I think that our unproductive obsessions are fueled by anxiety. They're fueled by our worries and our doubts and our fears and our anxieties. And because we are pretty anxious as a species, it's natural that the obsessions that arise in us are most usually unproductive ones. But our productive obsessions are fueled by our meaning-making needs. They arise because we're interested in things or curious about things. We're passionate about things, and we want to experience life as meaningful. And it's hard to experience life as meaningful if you're not interested and curious and passionate. And even interest isn't quite enough. I think you know, and lots of people cycle through mere interests almost day in and day out. Something interests them, but then it goes by the wayside. And that doesn't feel very meaningful to have a mere interest come and go. It's really more necessary to kind of elevate these interests and passions to actual productive obsessions, to really bite into something, to spend time with it, whether it's, you know, creating your home business or your radio show or your novel or whatever it is, to really tackle something and obsess about it and raise the bar.
Mm. So that's, you know, that's the whole concept here, is to channel these types of these obsessions and to make them something that inspires you in a positive way, in a very positive way. So listeners asking, this is a great question, what's the difference then between positive obsession and passion? Is there a difference?
I think possibly not, except in the way we use language. I think passions often tend to come and go and maybe don't gather as many neurons as an obsession does, because we're actually talking about a brain-based phenomenon here. Every thought, small thoughts, large thoughts, every thought grabs neurons. So what a thought is, it's neurons gathering to do some work. And if we're thinking small thoughts all day long, we're stealing our own neurons and we have no availability for those big thoughts. Well, passions may grab X number of neurons, but obsessions, I think, grab more neurons and keep them together over a longer amount of time. It's the durability of what's called a neuronal gestalt, a durability of the gathered neurons staying put over time that distinguishes this phenomenon from mere passion. It's the way, to take one kind of example, it's the way a Beethoven can hear a folk tune when he's 28 and turn that into a symphony when he's 48. Somewhere, neurons have been holding that folk tune and holding it over time. And that's the kind of obsessiveness.
What you described is just, I think that sounds like a memory to me.
Absolutely, because if you're, let's say you're working on your novel and you're obsessed about your novel, what you're doing is what's sometimes called remote association. You know, you're grabbing something in memory over here from your trip to Bosnia, from something over here about your childhood in Iowa. You're grabbing things. So memories absolutely go into this idea of productive obsessing. Everything that the brain can do, whether it's memory or sensing or thinking, has to do with neurons doing work. And so we can keep them in these separate compartments like memory, but in another sense, we have a whole brain working, and when we're obsessing, we're trying to get our whole brain to turn itself over to one thing so that we can focus better than usual.
I like your concept about neurons. I've always, my dad gave me a great description, he's a medical doctor, of what a memory is, and he's basically described it as neuron bridges. They build these little block or the pathways, and they bridge. So I've always known the greatest way to memorize things is short-term, medium-term, and long-term. You build a short block, and then you reinforce it with a medium block, and then you reinforce it with a long-term like block, and then it builds the memorization.
That's right, and these productive obsessions we're talking about do exactly the kind of thing
they do
that you're describing, because it really is building one day upon the next. If you start a novel and you don't really like it and you drop it after one day, no real bridges have been built, so to speak, you know, to use this language we're using here. But if you struggle to stay put with the novel and think hard and show up at your desk for those 2 hours each day, then you will be building bridges to those corners, to those recesses of the mind where you have all kinds of things stored. And that actually makes a person feel proud. It's not just about accomplishing work, but it kind of makes you feel proud to be accessing all that information you've stored over time and had no way to use previously. That's why it feels so good to create. We're making use of stored memories, stored feelings, stored ideas that had no place to go.
Well, this could definitely help to beat the boredom blues, but L.A. is not a place where people get bored really easily because there's so much to do in a big city like this. This, however, I'm seeing as a really great flashlight into procrastination. I can see that if you look at the way the brain works around these, quote, productive obsessions, you will be less likely to procrastinate on something that you're productively obsessing over, yeah?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I try to suggest to clients, and I work with creative and performing artists as a coach, is that they institute a morning practice around their obsession. And that sounds straightforward enough because, you know, in a busy life, if you have a day job and what have you, it's hard to get to your obsession late in the day. We get tired. We have fewer neurons available. So it's really smart to get to your work first thing in the morning, maybe in that 5:30 to 6:30 hour before your real day starts. But not only do you get work done when you do that, and not only do you build this habit that takes care of procrastination over time, but you also get to make use of your sleep thinking, which is a really important point because we think while we sleep, we dream while we sleep, we also think while we sleep. And if you turn to your work first thing in the morning, whether it's writing your novel or building your business or whatever, you can make use of whatever you've been thinking about all night. And that really adds richness to the thinking process.
I'd love to be able to retrieve that. I've had some great dreams, and I know that they're burned into my subconscious. I cannot figure out what they meant or what they were in the morning.
Yeah, or what to do with them, so to speak. Yeah. And I think that's right. I think that when you're working on something, when you have like a container for your passion, then your dreams and your night thoughts have a place to go, so to speak. And so when you wake up and turn to your novel, then whatever you've been thinking about or dreaming about has that place, and it will come right up. And you actually get a lot more creating time in. It's not just the hour you're writing, but you're getting to make use of all of that time that you've been thinking and dreaming about things during the night.
Now, I noticed that among a lot of books that you've written that you are a cultural observer. What is a cultural observer? Because culture fascinates me, and especially modern culture, where we all think that we're doing things individually, but we're really not. We're doing them as a norm, as a part of a norm. How did that come into play with your book? And really, who's the book for? I mean, what was the purpose in writing a book like this?
Well, let me start with the second point. I think it's for everybody. Of course, I write mainly for creative and performing artists, and I've done 15 or 20 books for creative and performing artists. And so that's perhaps my main audience, but it is a book for everyone because I think people still feel, even if they're not quite using the language, they still feel the remnants of the human potential movement, and they would like to make use of their potential, and they're rushing around all day, surviving and doing things, maybe some things that are of interest, but mainly getting through the day and not finding it so easy to get to their real deep thoughts. So I wanted to suggest this as a model and a metaphor and also a way to change that around so that you could think better about what damage all of the small thoughts we think are doing, how to release the grip of those small thoughts and how to start having bigger thoughts. So it's for anyone who would like to make herself proud and realize her potential, anyone who's feeling that lack that maybe they haven't realized their potential yet. I think it's a book for them.
Or stop with the small thoughts.
Or stop with the small thoughts.
And they mean, right. By small thoughts, in the context we're talking about, is the insignificant, obsessive, kind of meaningless what ifs, you know, things that haven't happened yet.
Not only that, just the things on our perpetual to-do list. I mean, just needing to remember to pick up the kids at 3 grabs neurons. Hmm. And that's not an irresponsible thought. That's a necessary thought. But by small thoughts, I mean not just negative thoughts, but also our everyday, ordinary, responsible thoughts. And, of course, the logical question is, well, how do we get rid of those? Because we actually need them. And so we're not trying to get rid of every small thought. What we're trying to do is at least carve out some time, that hour or two or three, at least, let's say, an hour, where you're not thinking about picking up the kids. You're not battering yourself with your thoughts, but you're also not working on your perpetual to-do list. You've really emptied your mind for that hour, released the grip of neurons on all those small thoughts, and for at least that hour, get your whole brain back so that you can do your best thinking.
So that you can chunk up and think about the bigger picture of life or of your purpose or of what it is that you're working on in your project, but in a bigger way.
That's right. And even just discover what interests you. I'm not sure people really know what interests them. They certainly, know how to run around and look interested, but that's not quite the same as being genuinely interested. I think at 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, we really knew what interested us. We loved books and music and nature and science or whatever it was, with a naive and simple and straightforward love. And now I'm not so sure we know exactly what interests us. And so one of the steps in this process of productively obsessing is to take the time to, almost in a mechanical way, write a list of what interests you to see if there's anything on that list that maybe looks like it wants to jump that next level to passion or obsession.
It's interesting. I played this this memory card, this 100-card memory card game with my 7-year-old, and it's 100 different animals, and you just have to match the animals, and you turn the cards over one by one. You've played that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she gets like double the amount of cards that I get every single time I play her, and I'm trying to figure out, why am I so distracted that I cannot remember I turned over the pig 15 times?
That's right. Because you're also thinking 26 other thoughts somewhere just in a corner of consciousness, and she isn't.
Completely. She's focused on that one thing. Her mind is not cluttered.
That's right. And that's why sometimes childhood is called an obsessive-compulsive time, not in a negative way, but in a positive way, because, you know how it is with kids or maybe with yourself, you discover an author, Nancy Drew, mysteries,
right.
And then you want to read all 30 of them.
Right, right.
You can't get enough of it. You're obsessed with it. It doesn't look like, hand-washing obsession. It's a positive obsession because it's just so, feels so rich to the child, feels so rich to you in childhood, to know every statistic if baseball interests you or... It really is an obsessive feel, and it's because you're really, truly enjoying yourself.
Can I call my cleaning obsession a positive obsession or a negative one?
We'd have to look at that one closely.
Okay, time for therapy. What is your obsession? What is your positive obsession?
It's probably still books, but it's also, this human animal that we are. And as you mentioned before, it's culture. I'm always interested in what's sometimes called the cultural trance, namely all the stuff that we're bombarded with that becomes our background noise that's so hard to avoid operating from. It's really hard to step out of that trance. People try to do it by, moving to other countries or doing one thing or another, but then you're in the cultural trance of that country. So it's very hard to separate yourself from what all institutions want to throw at you, all institutions with a small c, because all institutions are conservative with that small c just because they want to propagate themselves and they have agendas to push. And so they're always telling us things to think, and it's really hard not to buy into. We can sort of shed or avoid, 63% of them because we're smart and we know, they're doing this to me and they're doing that to me. But there's always that 37% where we're not even catching that they're doing it to us.
Right. I mean, look at advertising. There's constant bombardment of billboards all around you to keep your attention, even if, to just the phone ringing and stuff like that. I mean, this is a really great way. People ask me all the time, how do I quiet my mind? Mm-hmm. How do I meditate? How do I do something? Where do I start? And this is a good way. It's kind of like an active meditation that you're talking about, is to find one thing to focus on for a little while.
Yeah. We're talking about the cultural trance. But one thing that pops to mind is, and, I work with lots of writers, and I often have to tell writer clients that when they see someone interviewed, because of the way interviews work, if a writer on an interview says, this is my first book and da-da-da, it usually doesn't come up that it's really his fourth book, that he has three, manuscripts sitting somewhere that didn't quite work. So other writers who are working on their first book don't quite understand how often things fail, how often creative and performing artists do things that don't work, because they're only hearing about successes often in these interviews, because the interviews naturally enough are focused on the latest movie or the latest book or what have you,
right?
And don't want to look the interview. Neither the interviewer nor the interviewee really wants to look back on the long, maybe very rocky process that this person has lived through to get to this book. And this becomes a part of the cultural mythology that first books are really first books when they're more like fourth books. And so we don't, as a culture, quite see all the mistakes and messes that people make in order to, before they get that excellent result. It's just another example of how no one is really colluding to do anything mischievous, but it just happens that we don't get full information.
And what does that have to do with unproductive obsessions?
Well, I think it directly relates in the sense that people, again, my clients primarily, creative and performing artists, worry more than they ought to because they're not getting a full picture of the universe. And so by not getting that full picture, by, for instance, you know, if you're the typical writer, you know that you're to look for a literary agent and or an editor down the road, but because you never see that enacted, you know, you don't see what a literary agent-writer interaction looks like, you build that up into such a momentous, monumental thing in your mind, you get so worried about that interaction that it's easy to obsess about how difficult that's going to be. Sort of the opposite of normalizing it. Instead of making it seem like a normal interaction between a buyer and a seller, it becomes this horribly momentous thing, and that can easily turn into a negative obsession.
I can see, and this is a great conversation, by the way, for this, like, a local radio show in Los Angeles, because Eric Maisel has written all sorts of books, 30, including Coaching the Artist Within and Fearless Creating, the all sorts of books that have to do with performance-related coaching. Mm-hmm. And so if you have that screenplay that hasn't been made, or that book or that television project or an acting job and things like that, it is almost an enemy in your mind to obsess over it rather than taking on something that you can productively obsess over that's a bigger, broader picture. Chunk it up, going for purpose, going for meaning. That's what you're talking about, right?
That's right, and there's also a very intricate dance that creative and performing artists need to learn, the dance between attachment and detachment, because you want to attach. When we talk about productive obsessions, we're really talking about attaching to our own ideas, manifesting interest and passion, being ambitious, having an ego, all of those things. But then, at some point, you need to detach and let go of outcomes and let your product be out in the marketplace and deal with criticism and rejection and all of those things with a thick skin and from that place of detachment. And it's actually very hard to manipulate that dance of attachment and detachment, because first you're throwing in, you know, good juices into the project, you're attaching to it, you want it to work, and then at some point, and this is the case, at some point you have to let go of all of that and move to this other more dispassionate, phlegmatic, philosophical place when you put your work out there. So it's actually quite difficult to do.
That's a great piece of advice for people that are either waiting to hear back from an audition or things like that, because the more you obsess over something, it explains from a neurological perspective that the neurons are basically wasted on the obsessing, as is the energy wasted on the obsessing, and
Absolutely.
It doesn't free you up for other things.
That's right. And the people we're talking about are always waiting for something.
Mm-hmm. Aren't we all?
You know, you turn in a manuscript, or you're waiting for your book to come out, or we're always waiting for something. If you're obsessing in that waiting period, you're actually going to waste months and years of time in that waiting period obsessing about what you hope will happen or what you hope won't happen. And it's just so much more productive and fruitful to, as soon as the project is done and you've done your adequate marketing and you've put it out there, to let that go and to move on to the next productive obsession, to be a serial productive obsessor. You know, get on with the next thing.
Yeah.
Pay attention to the thing you just did, and, you know, keep its life alive in the marketplace. But move on to the next thing. Don't sit there and wait.
That explains a lot. That really does. Thank you so much. I mean, you really have encapsulated this in a great way, and it's really great for our LA audience and for all the projects that they've got going on out there. This is a really good thing to hear, and it explains so much too. It also explains a lot about the law of attraction, if you really think about it. So thank you so much. I appreciate your contribution today. And we'll be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to The Aware Show.